Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Nick Blumberg. Brandis Friedman is on assignment. Here's what we're looking at.
Today is an historic day in the city of Chicago.
The city council approves the centerpiece of the mayor's affordable housing plan. No new pope yet after the first day of voting. What to know about the conclave? And a Bronzeville project years in the making finally makes some headway. And now to some of today's top stories. Raja Krishnamoorthy makes it official. He wants to be Illinois' next U.S. senator. The five-term Democratic congressman who represents parts of the northwest suburbs has been widely rumored to be interested in the seat being vacated by Dick Durbin. Krishnamoorthy's been a prolific fundraiser with some $19 million already in his war chest. He's set to face off against recently announced contenders, Congresswoman Robin Kelly and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton in the 2026 Democratic primary. In announcing his run, Krishnamoorthy highlighted his parents who immigrated from India and raised him in Peoria and said he'll be a defender of the middle class.
I think that we Democrats should never be the party that defends the status quo. We're always agitating for change. We're always trying to make it better. Why? Because we want government to work.
Illinois Democrats and immigrant advocates are pushing back against Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Noem was in Springfield today where she said state and local sanctuary policies that limit cooperation with federal immigration authorities put public safety at risk. And she laid blame at the feet of Governor J.B. Pritzker and Democratic lawmakers. But opponents say Noem's criticisms aren't grounded in the facts about the lower rates at which immigrants commit crimes.
This governor has bragged about Illinois being a firewall against President Trump's immigration enforcement agenda. And it is very clear that he is violating the Constitution of the United States because it is a federal law that the federal government and the president set and enforce immigration policies.
Secretary Noem's statements about sanctuary policies are simply not true. Her statements made today and the federal administration's policies and rhetoric on this issue further spread misinformation, fuel hate against immigrants and Latinos, and quite frankly, do nothing to make our community safer.
Rideshare workers and union organizers rallied in Springfield on Wednesday, saying drivers should have the right to organize. They're calling on lawmakers to pass legislation that would allow drivers to join a union. The status of drivers has long been contentious, with many arguing they're effectively employees of companies like Uber and Lyft, while rideshare companies contend they're contractors. Illinois lawmakers have contemplated legislation in the past. Workers and union leaders argue today that drivers face safety hazards, lower wages than they deserve, and a lack of workplace protections. Up next, the city council approves the centerpiece of the mayor's affordable housing plan. What it entails right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
The City Council voted 30-18 today to take a new approach to reducing Chicago's massive affordable housing shortfall. It gives Mayor Brandon Johnson a major victory as he prepares to mark the second anniversary of his inauguration. Let's listen to the mayor take a bit of a victory lap after the vote.
For the people of Chicago who have longed for a transformation, that day is here. Here we are at the halfway point of my administration. We were able to take the hopes and aspirations of working people in the city of Chicago, working with city council, working with developers, to bring this historic ordinance into fruition.
WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now with more. Heather, Chicago is now the largest city in the United States to create its own nonprofit housing developer. How exactly will it work?
Well, this new organization is going to be governed by a 15-member board. The mayor will have 7 appointments that will have to be confirmed by the city council. The rest will be made up of city officials, including the commissioner of the Department of Housing. Now, it will be funded with $135 million that the city borrowed about a year ago as part of Mayor Johnson's sort of move away from tax increment financing districts. So that will create a revolving loan fund that the city hopes will build what it calls green social housing, affordable housing in mixed-use development that will be environmentally sustainable.
Well, and I know today's vote came after hours of debate and some pretty intense negotiations, behind the scenes. What changed to get it over the finish line?
Well, the biggest change in the version that actually passed today gives the Office of the Inspector General and the Chicago Board of Ethics jurisdiction over this new created nonprofit developer. So they have the authority to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. Also, it encourages the new nonprofit developer to prioritize building units that are affordable for the poorest Chicagoans, people earning less than 30% of the area's median income, which is $36,000 for a family of four.
Yeah, ethics and transparency, something top of mind for
Indeed.
A lot of Chicagoans. The city is facing a housing shortfall of more than 119,000 units. Supporters of the plan say the city is also facing, some new challenges. Why do they think this work is particularly urgent right now?
Three words, President Donald Trump. His budget proposal released this week would slash funding for affordable housing across the nation. It would hit Chicago particularly hard. So the supporters said today, we have to take matters into our own hands. We can't rely on the federal government, which of course has a lot of tax credit and other subsidies out there that may be a thing of the past in the very near future.
Especially with an administration that's not necessarily particularly friendly to Chicago at
Indeed.
The moment. Heather Sharone, thanks very much.
Thanks, Nick.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. As expected, it was black smoke billowing out of the Sistine Chapel today. 135 eligible cardinals have gathered for the first papal conclave in 12 years, sequestered in the Vatican, sworn to secrecy, and charged with electing the next pope. After Wednesday's lone ballot, cardinals are set to vote four times each day until two-thirds of them agree on a successor to the late Pope Francis. Tens of thousands of people have gathered in St. Peter's Square with their eyes on that famous chimney, awaiting the white smoke that signals a new Holy See. Joining us to discuss the process and more about the potential next pope are Michael Murphy, director of Loyola University's Hank Center, Father Patty Gilger, a priest of the Midwest Province of the Society of Jesus, and Paula McQuaid, a professor of English and Catholic Studies at DePaul University. Thank you all for joining us to talk about this. Father Gilger, cardinals are sequestered during the vote. They're sworn to secrecy. Why is that so important to the process?
Yeah, I think it's especially important, not just for historical reasons, because as we all know, there have been power players, political agents interested in affecting the outcome in their favor of papal elections in the past. But really, these days, we want to have secrecy, not to keep things, private underneath the vest, but really to have a space for freedom. Mm-hmm. So we want to be able to have the cardinal electors be able to really say what they think is going on in the church and the world to one another in an atmosphere of openness and prayer. And so the secrecy really is meant to protect that. It seems a little strange for us as Americans because we're so used to using the public sphere as a place to protect freedom of speech. We bring everything into the open there, but really the objective for the secrecy is the exact same, a space where people can say what they really think, pray together, think together, hopefully elect a beautiful pope.
Yeah, in Chicago, we tend to think of the back room as something unethical, but in this case, it does help to protect the process. Paula McQuaid, what sorts of meetings and conversations, whether formally or informally, are cardinals having in the run-up to the conclave?
Oh, I actually think a lot of the work happens in the run-up. There's two or three days before before they're sequestered, mm-hmm. in which the cardinals are meeting with one another, and they give these speeches, which are called interventions, and they can be absolutely crucial in deciding who the next pope is. I mean, it's rumored, for example, that Francis, one of the main reasons he was elected in 2013 is because he gave an intervention urging, precisely like Patty's saying, that we need to bring Christ out into the world, and that the other cardinals, I think we can't discount that they're actually moved and feel themselves to be inspired inspired by the Holy Spirit and by what a lot of these speeches are saying. So I think it's incredibly important what happens before the conclave, as important as what happens afterwards, or during.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Michael Murphy, Pope Francis widely seen as a progressive leader, you know, and some of observers say a lot of the shifts were especially in tone and in public presentation, even more so perhaps than, you know, changes in doctrine. How do you think Francis's legacy might shape cardinals' thinking during this process?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think about Pope Francis, you know, progressive, I mean, depends on who you ask, you know, is the gospel progressive? You know, possibly. You know, what model of the church do you ascribe to and prescribe? But his legacy, you know, his fingerprints are on this in a kind of a loving way. You know, having appointed over 80% of the cardinals, are they all going to walk in lockstep with Francis' thinking? Likely not. You know, there's a freedom there, but the way he touched the world. You know, I remember vividly, 2013, all these cell phones were going off. And, you know, and he was a global citizen, and I can think of no better leader globally than Pope Francis, especially at this moment. The media has only gotten more robust, but I think his touch, his tenderness, his hope, his joy, these are the things I'm hoping will make the imprint on the church.
Well, although it's obviously tough to say, you know, a few of the at least reported front runners heading into the conclave. There's Cardinal Pietro Parolin, who's the Secretary of State under Pope Francis, Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa, you know, a biblical scholar, Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, the so-called Asian Francis, Cardinal Luis Tagle from the Philippines, Cardinal Peter Erdo from Hungary, some more conservatives' favorite. Father Gilger, does being a front runner mean much, or does the enter a pope, leave a cardinal maxim still hold true?
I think the latter will hold true in these cases. But for me, that is actually a very exciting thing, because there have been times where the church, I think, collectively knew what the issues were that we were facing, and that gave us a stronger sense of how we might be able to respond to them, really who we might be able to look to help us respond to these kinds of issues. I am not convinced yet that the church has quite of a sense of what the problems are that we're facing. And in those interventions, as you were saying there, Paula, those are the kinds of moments where people from all over the world, this highly international, the most international church we've ever had here represented in the cardinalate, can really respond to one another by telling the stories that they've heard from being pastors of the people of God around the world. If they can be attentive to one another in that way, we're going to see something very surprising happen here in their conversations and in their prayer.
Yeah. Well, you know, and to that point, Paul McQuaid, you know, Pope Francis worked to bring in a lot of voices, especially from outside of Europe, places where the church is growing, regions like Africa and Asia. I mean, I think, is it fair to say we expect that to affect this conclave, if, you know?
I think it will absolutely affect the conclave. How it will affect the conclave, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, is what I would say, because I think it's, while you can generalize, I think it's very difficult once you get in there and you're listening. So I think it will affect it. He's also, as you know, appointed a lot of cardinals. They were appointed by him, but I'm just not sure. I wouldn't say it's predictive. Mm-hmm. I would say it's going to impact it.
Yeah. One of the things that we've seen a little bit is that in the general interventions here, the initial interventions over the last handful of days, the first ones were often made by some of the older cardinals. They're all old. But the ones who were over 80 and could not participate in the election.
Yeah.
And so what that allowed, those first speeches, people noticed that they were not overly critical of Francis, but they were critical. Mm-hmm. And people were saying, well, we're not entirely sure about some of these changes that have been made. But as time went on, and some of the younger cardinals who are also electors from all over the world got to speak, what we tended to see were people who were more in tune with what we call the synodal, the listening, the accompanying style of Pope Francis. That doesn't mean they agreed with everything that Francis did either, but it does mean that we're moving forward in the same kind of spirit, and those men were the ones who will be in the room and be able to make these decisions.
I just want to say, that's fascinating, because what you're suggesting is it's a difference in style, that the style difference is going to be more important, and the listening rather than with ideas necessarily. That's fascinating.
Yeah, Michael, you wanted to add something?
Sure, I'll just say, 70 countries this time around in 2013, there were cardinals from 48 countries. So that's the good news. A more global church fits Francis's vision. The bad news is they don't know each other as well, but they also spent two Octobers together in synod. So they do know each other in lots of ways. To think about, you know, handicapping this papacy, the next pope, I mean, it's, people have been betting on this since the 16th century. So,
and now they can bet on their phone.
Right, exactly.
I think that technology has touched this conclave more than anything.
Yes.
But I'm also going to say that with all that kind of like social media kind of instrumentalization of tech, that there's a hunger for transformation from non-Catholics who are way more sympathetic this time around to the conclave and the papacy than I've noticed in a long time.
It does seem like there is a great degree of attention on this, even from among non-Catholics.
Yeah.
You know, do you think that's down in some way to the sort of work Francis did as a global citizen, perhaps?
Certainly. No, yeah. Paula, certainly.
Absolutely. I was going to agree. And to social media. I mean, he was I think the next pope... Yeah. I think they are looking for someone who's going to be adept at social media and how to use
There's
it.
There's more fights within the Catholics sometimes than outside of the church.
100%.
Yeah. Well, you know, and Father Gilger, I know you said there's the Pope has to balance a lot of roles. You know, they're a pastor, they're a public face, they're an administrator. What are some of the qualities that you're looking for in the next Pope when it comes to balancing those things?
Yeah, so if we just take those two trajectories that you're naming for us, Nick, I think those are very helpful because we can kind of look, as we would say, in a little bit of Latin, ad intra, we can look ad extra. Mm-hmm. The ad intra needs are significant. The Church has real financial issues going on right now, and there are structural changes that Pope Francis has begun that need to be stabilized or solidified or altered in ways that the next pope will see fit to do. Mm-hmm. And we need someone who is a really astute administrator, someone who knows how to work with others collegially, collaboratively, to declare stable roles. What are you really taking care of and how are you doing that? That internal stuff does need to be done. But the external stuff, Pope Francis just shown so much there. So we really do need someone who can be the Latin word also for the, another Latin word for the papacy is pontifex. It just means to be a bridge builder.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we want a pope who can both build a bridge internally to people inside the church and externally to those who are far beyond
us. Really quickly, because there's, I mean, for the American viewers out here, you know, there is a local guy, Cardinal Robert Prevost, mm-hmm. who is the only papabile I've heard in a long time. It's probably not going to happen. But he has the right temperament that Patty's kind of adducing here. He's a great administrator, a balanced disposition, a global person. So that might be one of these dark horses, too.
It'll be very interesting to see what comes of this. I know you three will be watching it closely, and certainly many millions of people as well. That's where we'll have to leave it for now. But thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Up next, details into a new trail making headway in Bronzeville. A historical train route is in line for a new life. The Bronzeville Trail Revitalization project is underway after years of planning. It aims to turn a disused rail line in the historic district into a path for walking, biking, and gathering. The west end of the trail will start near 40th and Dearborn Streets, extending eastward 2 miles along 41st Street and ending at Lake Park Avenue. Organizers hope to honor the area's cultural significance and help improve the community's health outcomes and opportunities. Joining us with more on the project are John Adams, Executive Director and Founder of the Bronzeville Trail Task Force, and John Gay, Leading Architect for the project and Founder of the architecture firm Jack. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Appreciate you.
You know, John Adams, you've been working on this project for about 5 years now. I know there's a lot that's gone into getting up to this point. Tell us briefly where things currently stand with the development of the trail.
Sure. In October of 2024, the city of Chicago committed $5 million for a pilot activation of the trail project. And that was after the city had commissioned a feasibility study, which certainly concluded that it's feasible. And the first commitment, the first spending of that $5 million was to produce the urban planning document, which is known as a framework plan. And the city led a task order in March to pre-qualified bidders. And those bids were due by April 15th, 2025. And so literally, we're anxious and waiting for the city to make a selection, which we think perhaps might be by the end of next week. And then we'll know who the lead consultant, the prime consultant, will be on the framework plan.
That's an exciting point in the project. Yeah. You know, John Gay, this line used to carry freight and passenger trains. What kind of work are you looking to do in terms of remediating and preserving this embankment?
Sure. So from a remediation standpoint, of course, it has to be cleaned up. And, you know, there we don't know exactly what the plan will be yet and how deep we need to go to remove soil. That study still has to take place. But with respect to what can come once the cleanup has happened is a review of natural and native plant life that was there originally. We want to bring that back. Of course, we want to restore the overpasses. So the trail then becomes connected. Also, there's stations that can be reactivated for different uses that become hubs of activity for the neighborhood.
And I know you've already begun, you know, gathering stories around the trail's history. How do you plan to incorporate them into the project?
Sure. So for starters, those stories are going to manifest into a podcast series, okay? And then the archive gets built and built and built, and then there will be QR codes along the path that will allow folks to be able to jack in, if you will, and experience some of the history as they're traversing the trail.
And, you know, John Adams, I know this train line has a lot of history, including its proximity to the Roberts Temple Church. Remind us the significance behind that.
Oh, my gosh. Certainly it was Johnson Publishing that made the decision to print the photos of an open casket of Emmett Till that happened in 1955. And certainly there are a lot of archival photos to show all the people who took the time to view his body, and certainly movies now have been made about Mamie and Emmett Till, as well as Roberts Temple is now a national monument. And we knew when we began the project, just because of the proximity of the embankment to Roberts Temple, and it's literally adjacent, butts right up against the parking lot, that Roberts Temple was going to play a significant role. What I also wanted to mention, just to go back to your first question, is that the city committed after the framework plan is completed that we will go right into, and this is somewhat of a technical term, phase one construction. Mm-hmm. And the estimation is that particular task order would have about a $2 million price tag. And it gets a little more heavily into engineering and more architectural work. And so we anticipate that by 2028, the framework plan and phase one construction will be completed. And as Mr. Gay referenced, we're also looking to get the remediation done.
Well, you know, and I know you've got some financial support, several million dollars for the early phases, but it's likely you may need federal support for this. Do you foresee potentially running into roadblocks there, you know, given the current administration? And how are you thinking about trying to overcome that?
So we don't think right now it's problematic. The funds that the city has committed certainly going to take us right up to November of 2028. Wink, wink, hint, hint.
And what happens then?
So, yeah, that's right. And so, at least for now, you know, we're in good hands because all the dollars are local. Mm-hmm. But you certainly, you know, are pointing out that projects like this just simply don't happen without federal dollars. Mm-hmm. And certainly on the north side of Chicago, I mean, one of the poster childs of repurposing an embankment is the Bloomingdale 606 Trail. Mm-hmm. And my numbers could be off a little bit, but Mayor Emanuel was able to procure about $55 million from the federal government in order to make that trail a reality.
Yeah, certainly a key piece of support there. You know, John Gay, as this development goes forward, how do you hope to incorporate the community and the things that they want and need?
So absolutely. It will be an amenity to the community. And so you can't create an amenity for the community or tourism for the greater community without engaging. So there would be a lot of community engagement up front to pull the community in. And actually, from our perspective, we like making sure we understand the rhythm of our client, the rhythm of the community, and pull it together so it all comes together as an architectonic experience. So from the landscaping to the bridges to the furniture to the murals to the activation of the stations, the community will be totally involved and embraced as part of the design process for that.
I can imagine it feels very gratifying to see the project come this far, and we're looking forward to seeing how it develops, but we'll have to leave it there. John Adams and John Gay, thank you both for joining us to talk about
this. Thank you.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.